Thank you, Mr. Pacelli. So today, we are going to continue on. If you remember from 2 weeks ago, I started a message on the abomination of desolation. We got through the first half of that, discussing the first time that we saw this occurrence. It was a partial fulfillment of what we're expected to see in the future as far as the end time that we read in Daniel chapter 12. Today, we're going to touch on the second time that we see this happen. But what before that, if you happen to miss it, if you haven't had a chance to go back and watch it, I did want to do a quick recap. We'll run through, check and see. There we go. Thank you, Mr. Kubik. All right, so we start out in Daniel 12 where it talks about the actual end time prophecy that we're going to be, that we are looking for, what we're waiting on in our time now. It talked about a couple of different things that are going to be happening. It tells us that there's going to be an abomination of desolation, there's going to be sacrifices that are stopped, and it's going to last 1290 days. And so we read that through Daniel chapter 12. We talked about a little bit of Daniel and the history of what he lived through, his lineage of where he came from, but that wasn't really the main idea. Then we get into Daniel 2. We talked about this framework that we're given in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We're told that this dream, this statue, is actually the four empires that we go through within Daniel, and this is what is prophesied about. We have Babylon as the first empire, the Medes and the Persians who come in and defeat them, the Greeks who come in after that, and then the Roman Empire after that. And that's this basis, this outline that God has given us throughout history of the importance of these empires and how it works with Jesus Christ at his return. A little bit of what we went through in Daniel chapter 8, we talked about this another dream that Daniel ended up having, this vision that he saw about the ram with two horns, which represented the Medes and Persians because it had the offset horns. One was larger than the other. And we know that eventually Persia was stronger and therefore dominated the Medes at that point. That ram, it was in the vision, there was a goat that came on the scene with one giant horn. It ended up trampling this ram who had trampled everything else in its path. And this one giant horn represents Alexander the Great of the Greek Empire. And that is this basis of, we have this one horn who, he was the king at that time, who unified all of Greece. And all of a sudden in this vision, this horn breaks. At the pinnacle of its power, this horn just breaks. Breaks up into four different smaller horns. And then on one of the four horns is a even smaller one than that. Just a little tiny horn on one of the four. What we end up seeing is that this small horn on one of the four represents the abomination of desolation, or the transgression of desolation at this time in history. That is what represents it, because those four horns represented the four generals that were underneath Alexander the Great who took power, which eventually merged into two different ones. If you remember back, we talked about how in the north we had Turkey and Syria, where the Seleucids were, and then down in Egypt were the Ptolemies, and these two just constantly battled. After Alexander the Great, there was no unification of the Greek Empire. It was just a constant power struggle to see who could actually be in control, because there was no successive king after Alexander. And so that leads us to this point of getting down to this transgression of desolation, who this was. It talked about, let's see. We're going to jump. I started talking a whole lot faster than I was clicking. So one of the things we discussed was the difference between the 2300 days versus mornings and evenings that we recognize as 1150 days, because at that time they did sacrifices in the morning and in the evening. So it wasn't 2300 days per se as we know days, but it was really 1150 days. And that's where Antiochus Epiphanes, he is the one that stopped these sacrifices. He is that little horn that appeared on one of the four. Antiochus Epiphanes hated everything about God, hated everything about the people, and he's the one that came in, stopped the sacrifices, and ended up destroying much of Jerusalem at that time. He conquered Jerusalem. He killed a lot of the people, and he just created destruction. So this Antiochus Epiphanes is the first example that we have of a transgression of desolation, or the abomination of desolation, as it's called later. And so that's basically what we went through in Daniel chapter 8. That's my quick summarized version, 2, 3, 5 minute, whatever it ended up being, summarized version. So if you want to catch up on some of those details, you have to go back and listen to the message from 2 weeks ago. But that leads us now into, we can discuss a second time that we've seen this happen. So around 164 BC, we have it with Antiochus Epiphanes, and then we have it happen again a second time, which we're going to look at this period of about 3.5 years, which ended up happening in a similar fashion to what we experienced with Antiochus Epiphanes. But there were some differences. But what happened was in 166, the Jewish people decided that they had had enough of being trampled on and ruled over, and they rebelled against the Roman Empire. They thought they were going to take back. The problem with that is that they really had no understanding of how domineering, how powerful the Roman Empire was at that time. An example that we have is one of the Jewish leaders at that point in time, Josephus. He was a Jewish officer who fought against the Roman Empire and ended up, he was eventually captured and he was taken to Rome. And during this process, he understands that they're not fighting this small army, this small empire that would be easily overthrown. He sees the dominance that the Roman Empire has, and when he returns, he tries to plead with the Jewish people and says, listen, we don't know what we're up against. We had no idea what we were facing. He tries to come to some negotiation between the Roman Empire and the Jews. He tries to convince them that, you know, this is going to lead to destruction. And what happens, the rebels, the Jewish rebels who were fighting against the Roman Empire, they didn't trust him because he was basically turning on them. The Roman Empire didn't trust him because he was still a Jew. And so he got caught in the middle, and nobody trusted what he had to say. And this basically ends with the destruction of Jerusalem over this 3.5 year period. Now, it wasn't the total destruction because the city lasted on for some period of time, but there was a lot of this of Jerusalem that was devastated. There was a lot of destruction that did go on. One of the primary things that was destroyed was the temple. We know the temple was completely desecrated and brought to the ground at this point in time. If we look at some of the numbers as far as historically with battles, we know that this was one of the greatest battles in history as far as the number of people who had died. We have thousands of Roman soldiers who lost their lives. There was thousands of Jews that ended up dying, Jewish soldiers that were fighting against the empire who died. And then on top of that, if the numbers are actually accurate, Josephus records that there were approximately 1.1 million people who died between the wars, and primarily a lot think that the greater impact was actually from starvation and diseases. It wasn't even the fighting itself. Most of that 1.1 was actually from starvation and disease that caused a lot of this. But we see this destruction that occurred in Jerusalem at this time and how it impacted the people so negatively. We see these wars. We see rumors of wars. We've got these two nations fighting against each other in a guerrilla warfare type of style. One's trying to get their independence. The other one's trying to take over everything that they have. And it's just a nasty thing. We don't ever see anything good come from battle, from war. We, as humans, have never seen any positive things come from it. It leads to destruction and division. As they go through this, we end up seeing, through this time period, it ends up with the siege of Masada, where over 900 Jews, instead of surrendering to the Roman Empire, they committed suicide. They took their own lives, because they figured that was better than admitting defeat and turning over to the Roman Empire. So we see all of this destruction that takes place in Jerusalem during this time frame. We've got the wars, the rumors of wars, we have pestilence, we have diseases, epidemics, starvation going on. Things were so dire that it's recorded that even recordings of cannibalism took place during this time period. So it wasn't pleasant by any means. Again, as humans, we see all this chaos that is construed because of us, decisions that humanity makes, and there's no good outcome. There's nothing good that ever comes from it. At this point in time in Jerusalem, they even had some signs in the skies. Josephus talks about different visions that people saw, that they saw in the skies. And it wasn't just the Jews. There's Roman recordings that the Romans recorded visions of, that they saw in the sky as well. And a lot of that correlates back to the things that we should think and that should sound familiar to us. Those things should link back to biblical passages as the things that we can recall that hit close to home for us. Because that's what was said in the Olivet Prophecy. We see some of these different things occurring in the Olivet Prophecy. But before we head over there, I do want to take a look at Luke chapter 19. If you go over to Luke 19 with me, because Jesus gives a prophecy here that was actually fulfilled back in AD 70. And if Luke chapter 19, if you look at verse 41 and 42, we got to remember that all of this was written down before it occurred. There are scholars and there's commentators who disagree with that. They believe this was all written afterwards. But because we have the faith in the Bible and the chronology that it took place, Jesus said this before 70 AD. Before any of this ever took place, this is what Jesus said in Luke chapter 19. It's Luke 19, starting in verse 41, it says, "Now as he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, 'If you had known, even you, especially in this day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes.'" So all these prophecies talked about the Messiah coming. And he says, "I'm here with you today." And he says, "I'm right here, but the problem is, you don't get it. The problem is, I'm supposed to be here for you. I'm supposed to be here because of you, for you." He says, "But you've rejected me. You've rejected me." In verse 43, it says, "For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation." So we see that we have this, the time of visitation, the Son of God. He says, you know, they're going to come here. They're going to build an embankment around you. You guys are going to be surrounded. What does that exactly mean? Do we see that in history? Is that evidence that we have? And this is what Christ told him. We don't know whether Jesus was telling a large group of people here or whether he's talking just to the disciples, but we have it recorded for us. We have a document here from God that says this is what is going to take place. This is what I tell you. It's recorded for us. We know it's prophecy. We know this didn't take place. Or we know it wasn't said before it took place. This was Jesus Christ giving us information. Now when we compare what was said in the Olivet Prophecy, we think about the wars, rumors of wars. He tells the people in Jerusalem, he says, "Flee." He says, "Get out. Don't be there. It's not going to be good." And there were some who believe, and that means, you know, when we talk about the abomination of desolation and the Olivet Prophecy, we have people out there who believe this has already taken place. That these instances of prophecy are already completed. So when we look at the Olivet Prophecy, they think that this has already been fulfilled. Everything except for one or two select verses. There's a group out there. It's a pretty large group. And it's because we can go through these examples in the Bible that look very similar to what is referenced about the end time. But what we're going to look at is that we have clear scriptural backing that this hasn't fully happened yet. And that these two partial instances that have already happened, we can take bits and pieces from them to understand exactly what it is that we're looking for in the future. Because we know that's truth. We know what is happening at the end time, and that's how we can reference these back to these partial fulfillments, that these are smaller prophecies that are actually going to take place in a larger scale somewhere down the line. You know, we saw the first one with Antiochus Epiphanes. Here in Rome, with Rome in 70 AD, we see the second occurrence. Both of them experience a type of abomination of desolation. They experience bits and pieces as like the sacrifice is stopping. We see these instances that look like they correlate to the end time, but we don't have all the pieces. We don't have that greater fulfillment, and that's what we're going to get into and discuss. It doesn't mean that Daniel 12 and its future abomination desolation at the time of the resurrection has already occurred, because we can see some of these characteristics. Just because we have some of the characteristics doesn't mean that it's been fulfilled. And so we want to look at what's happening. What are we looking at? These bits and pieces. If you go back to Matthew 24, we'll now take a look here at the Olivet Prophecy, because this sets the stage in Matthew 24 for the Olivet Prophecy and why this prophecy hasn't been completely fulfilled yet, and what we're actually looking for. These people that I referenced that believe that the prophecy's already been fulfilled, it's a group, they're called preterists. They believe that all of the prophecy, everything except for a couple of scriptures, has been fulfilled. They don't think most of this is going to happen again. But for us, that's a big delineation, because there's big characteristics here that we should be looking for. That's the things that we're waiting on. They don't value that there's still prophecy to be fulfilled in a later point in time. And so what we start looking at and start understanding is that these first two partial fulfillments give us information for what's going to continue to happen again, what we're going to see down the line. And so if you take a look at Matthew chapter 24, towards the beginning, look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?'" So they're very clear. They're just like us. You know, we want to know when the end is. We want dates. We want people. We want all the information that we can possibly have so we can be 100% positive when and where this is going to be, so we don't miss the boat. Right? We like to have information. They were the same way. They wanted to know. They had desires of understanding what was going. And they say at the end of the age. Not the end of humanity, not the end of the existence of people, but at the end of the age when the resurrection occurs. And so he's not telling them about something that's going to happen a few years from now. Now we're looking at a 40-year gap from Jesus Christ's life approximately to when this 70 AD second partial occurrence of the abomination desolation is. They're not talking about that small time frame. They're talking about the end at Jesus Christ's return. And if we go back to verse 29, stay here in Matthew 24. If you go to verses 29 and 30, this is what we find. He says, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." Did we see all of that happen? Historically, do we have the information that says all of this is already done? No. No, we start understanding that there's still things that have to take place. Pieces of this that weren't done. This is a warning. Jesus Christ gives multiple warnings about things to look out for. We can't pull this section out and say, it's completed. All of these things took place. We don't have a historical record of that ever taking place. But we do know that Jerusalem was under siege in 66 to 70 AD, that there was this battle. We know biblically that there were Jews that fought against the Roman Empire. And we have more information because of history, because it has actually happened already. We can look at the facts and the details. One of the neat things about this occurrence, the second abomination of desolation, is that there's record. It's not biblical evidence, but we have historical evidence that there was indicated that during the siege, during this time period, there were a group of Jews that left. They fled. That was one of the things we talked about. God says, get out, flee, get away. There's record of this happening historically. It's not in the Bible, but through history, we can see that this took place. They received some supernatural sign that told them to get out. Get out of Jerusalem. Other people saw this. They heard this a voice that told them to leave. It was a group that they were the Christians. They were the ones that left Jerusalem. They got out before all of the destruction took place, before the total fulfillment of this. So they left during the siege. And there's reference to these people. They existed for hundreds of years. There's a record of them that they stayed in this little town of Pella. You can research that and find out some information. A lot of people refer to it as the Flight of Pella. You'll see that all you have to do is Google it, and you'll get some information if you're interested in looking at it. But it's this little town in Jordan where these people fled to. These people fled during the siege of Jerusalem. And years later, hundreds of years later, they have their ancestors, their descendants who say, yeah, our ancestors are the ones who fled. They're the ones who left. You know, they believe in Jesus Christ. They keep the Sabbath day, and they're still living there. So we see this example. They've been there hundreds of years as part of what this prophecy is. So we see glimpse and pieces. We didn't see that with the abomination of desolation, but we see it, or with Antiochus Epiphanes, but we see it here in 66 to 70 AD. So we have that small group. We have this small group that left. You know, it was nice for them. It helped spare their lives. But in the grand scheme of things, it didn't really change anything, did it? We still see historically that Jerusalem was completely demolished, that the temple was destroyed. These people, their lives were spared. They have their lineage that carries on. They were able to keep their faith the way they wanted. But that's not the greater fulfillment that we're looking for. There's still something that we're waiting on, something that's important to us now. There's something that didn't take place historically that we are still looking to the future for. That's what we're waiting on. We're waiting on this greater fulfillment. So if you look at Matthew 24, verse 15, we can look at some of this greater fulfillment that's supposed to come. It's going to come. We just don't know when. Matthew 24, verse 15, it says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and whoever reads this, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So there it is. We see that this is a reference that fleeing. He tells the people who are in Jerusalem at that time, he says, get out. You don't want to be there. Nothing good is going to come of this. He's trying to spare them of devastation. He's going to try to spare not only back then, that group that went to Pella, but there's going to be a future group that is told to get out, that they should leave. Because when we see this abomination of desolation takes place, it's going to be the same type of destruction. There's going to be the same horror, the same mutilation, the same issues that we see that humanity continues to face day in and day out when we try to run things our way. When we compare Luke and Matthew, these accounts are slightly different. They don't contradict each other, but we get a full picture of the Olivet prophecy when we put Matthew and Luke together. And we can look at these two different aspects of it, and we get a whole message. We get a whole understanding of what the Olivet prophecy is and what it means and what we're looking for in the future. And so we can see, because of some of these aspects, that clearly we're not done yet. These had not been fulfilled. We know that there's a future fulfillment of the Olivet prophecy that takes place when Jesus Christ returns, with a future abomination of desolation who's going to take place. Another abomination of desolation. So if we think about what we're looking at in the New Testament, what we're looking at for the future, we can think about what happened in 70 AD for a minute, because we know a lot of what happened. We know what happened with Antiochus Epiphanes. We went over that extensively last time. We discussed about the different things that he did and what he did with the temple, with stopping the sacrifices, what he did to the people themselves. But what exactly happened with the abomination desolation in 70? Well, Christ said that the abomination desolation would be a sign of his return. This abomination desolation would stand in the holy place. And that's what we need to get into a little bit of understanding, that there's a greater fulfillment that we're going to deal with. There's something else that's coming down the line. Because some of this involved an embankment around Jerusalem, armies surrounding them, which we find in 70 AD. But there's aspects of this that didn't exactly happen quite in 70 AD. So we have the Roman emperor that decides that he's going to just squash the Jewish people. He's fed up with dealing with what all of their little quarrel that they have, their little rebellion that they're putting up against him. And so he sends General Titus to try to just completely wipe out everything that's going on in Jerusalem. He's trying to finish this once and for all. He wants to conquer and destroy Jerusalem. And so he ends up sending the army led by General Titus. And that's what they do. That's what his mission is. He goes in. Sacrifices get stopped again, which we see through prophecy. At this point in time, they've been stopped for 2,000 years. Well, we're not given a time frame as to when they're exactly going to start back up. But that's one of those key things that has to be on our radar. What we're waiting for. What we're watching for. We don't watch the news to try to see exactly who everybody is or how it's playing out. We watch the news to try to look at the big picture. The framework that God has given us, and we work within that. We don't need to add details that aren't there. So here in 70 AD, they stopped the sacrifices again. They surrounded it with the Roman Empire, with the Roman army at that time, and they decided they're going to quit fooling around with dealing with Jerusalem. And they go in to squash it. It ends up, as they're looting the temple, that's part of what they try to do. Their plan was to take the temple and convert it into a Roman temple. But during this looting process, during all this fighting, the temple set on fire. And the temple is completely destroyed. It's burned to the ground. All basically wreckage occurs, and there's nothing left of what was known as the temple. So when they set up the statue and their pagan stuff, it was kind of done in the temple, kind of like Antiochus Epiphanes did, but at the same time, it wasn't really the temple anymore. It was completely destroyed. There was not much left, if anything, of the ruins of the temple. And that's where they established this new abomination of desolation. It's where they established what they were going to do with the Roman temple, what they did with their sacrifices. And Antiochus Epiphanes, he was able to actually stop the sacrifices, keep everything intact, set up his altar and his statues and sacrifice pigs. They weren't able to do that this time. The holy place was destroyed. It was destroyed in 70 AD. And from historical record, it looks like most of this was done by accident. That wasn't the intent, because they did want it as a Roman temple. They were going to use it for their purposes. It's just with all the chaos, with all the turmoil going on, it ended up, things happened. Things escalated. Oh, we know in dire situations, we're not always in control. And that's part of what happened. So let's think about what's going to happen in the future. So we see these aspects from Antiochus Epiphanes. We see 70 AD. Some of these prophesied events take place, but what is actually going to take place in the future? What are we looking for? If we go back to 2 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we can find here a prophecy about Jesus Christ before his return. And we know that the abomination desolation is going to be set up again, and it's going to he's going to be in the holy place. And that leads us to be able to make some conclusions. It gives us some information about what we're looking for. There's going to be literal sacrifices done again at some point in the future. How do we know this? It's because it's the way it was done the first two occurrences. We see that in 164 and we see it in 70 AD. There were sacrifices being done that were stopped. And so at some point we know that sacrifices are going to start again, because they have to be stopped again by the abomination of desolation. And some have tried to spiritualize this aspect of it and say, you know, this is going to happen within the church. It's not going to be physical events that take place. But that's not what the examples are that we're given. God has given us examples that there are physical sacrifices that are going to be taking place that will happen that's going to have to be stopped. And it's what happened the first two times. You know, there's going to be this place in Jerusalem that they do the sacrifices, that they consider to be the altar, this temple. That's how it happened the first two times. You know, that detail part is what we struggle with. We don't know if this is going to be a massive temple. We don't know if it's going to be a small temple. There are some spectacular temple plans out there. Is this extravagant temple again? But if we think about it, I mean, for years, the tabernacle was a tent. The sacrifices took place in a tent. So we don't know exactly what we're looking for. We don't know exactly the details of what this will look like. But we know that there's going to be sacrifices there. And that's going to be one of the telltale signs that help us to understand, okay, this is the place that's considered the temple. This is the altar that is made for the sacrifices. These are some of the details that we're looking for. If it's much smaller than we anticipate, we have to get past that. Because we have to look at the pieces that we're given. It could be a large building, it could be a small building, it may be a tent. But we know that they're going to be performing sacrifices on the altar. And that's how it has to be done. That's how it was done in the past. So in Jerusalem today, we sometimes think that maybe this is far away, but right now there's a group that has been working for years on preparing to do sacrifices again. They've been working in Jerusalem, getting everything ready. They have a group of Levites. They know they're Levites because they've traced their heritage all the way back to Aaron. By DNA, they have linked themselves back to Aaron. They are the Levitical priesthood. They plan, and they've been training to take the Levitical steps as to the duties of the priesthood, and they're going to start doing those again sometime in the future. That's not the only thing that they've done. And this isn't some secret organization. This has been instituted by the Israeli government. They know this is going on. It's accepted that it's going on, and they're preparing for a time when they're able to have control of the temple, whatever the temple may be at that point in time. So it's no secret. This is publicly known. One of the groups is called the Temple Institute. They have plans. They have a blueprint plans of what the temple is that they want it to look like. They've been working on setting everything up. The past 2 years, they've actually practiced doing the Passover sacrifices. They've been planning strategically to do all of this. They have over 60 different, they've actually created 60 different of 60 items of the sacred temple. They've already built them. They're preparing for it. The high priest breastplate with the 12 stones from each of the tribes. They have that ready. They have utensils that are used. They have musical instruments. They have a Levitical choir. They have the priestly garments. They have been working for years getting ready to reinstitute sacrifices and prepare for the next temple, the next altar. As of just a couple months ago, they have two red heifers that they believe are pure, that will be ready to actually purify the altar when it's ready. They still have to check it to make sure that there aren't any white hairs on them, so they're going to continue to check it, but they have two candidates for the red heifer to actually purify the altar. They've been diligently preparing for this time. All of this stuff that we're looking for and waiting for, they are actively pursuing. This prophesied events for us of what we are waiting on for the return of Christ, it's in the works. It's in play. We aren't like the preterists and think all of this has taken place and it's done. It's not. It is very much being prepared for. And those are the aspects we have to watch. That's why we watch the news. That's why we get ready. We don't watch it for all the destruction and terror and disaster and what government's angry at what government. Doesn't matter to us. We know all the governments are going to fail. It's inevitable. There won't be a government that's successful until Jesus Christ returns. That is the only government that's going to succeed. So it doesn't matter to us whether there's a Democrat or Republican in office. We know God has allowed it. He's either specifically placed them there or he's allowed it for his purpose. It doesn't matter to us. It doesn't change. This is our timeline. This is our framework of what we're waiting on and what we're looking to in the future. So if you look at 2 Thessalonians, right at the very beginning of chapter 2, he says, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." And so there were some people who came through Thessalonica. That's a tongue twister. Thessalonica. The Thessalonians. That's easier to say. Went through and was trying to say Jesus Christ had already come. What are you guys waiting on? This isn't going to happen. They're combating this idea that Jesus Christ is going to return in the future. And so what Paul's saying, he's telling them, he goes, you know, remember what you were taught. He goes, you know this isn't true. You know that's not the case. He said, remember what we taught you. And this is what we see. Look at verse 3. He says, "Let no one deceive you by any means that the day will not come, that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." So did we see that in 70 AD? Do we see this man who exalts himself as God, this divine figure that says, "I am the Messiah," in the temple? That's not what we find. We haven't seen that yet. We haven't seen this yet. This is something that's going to happen in the future. It's something that's going to take place at a later date. That's what we're waiting on. It might be a gigantic temple. It might be a tent. But we know that this person that is clearly not the Messiah, but views himself as God, is sitting in that temple. Some sort of temple. We have to be aware that this is going to take place. He claims his divinity. We know through other prophecies, they actually are able to do some divine things. There are miracles that are performed. It is a messianic figure. It looks to many people, the Messiah and what he would be doing. And he's going to sit in the temple. And this prophecy hasn't happened yet. We haven't seen this occur. It surely didn't happen in 70 AD. It didn't happen that way. But if we carry on, look at verse 5. It says, "Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." Now this is very interesting. If we weren't sure enough that this person actually hasn't sat in the temple yet, this is clear evidence that this has not occurred yet. This last aspect, this person, this divine, who claims a divine being, to claims to be God, is killed by Jesus Christ at his return. Consumed by Christ. Some people have claimed who this person is. Each time that person has died. It wasn't by Jesus Christ. So this hasn't been fulfilled. We don't know who that is yet. We're still waiting to find out who that actually was. The important thing is we remember that this person sits in the temple as if he was God. And it isn't until Jesus Christ returned that he's removed, that he's knocked down a couple pegs, whatever that temple may be. Let's carry on. Verse 9. It says, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Truth. The Word of God and understanding exactly what truth is and what He's doing. What He's doing with us. We have another abomination of desolation that's going to be set up. We're going to have another temple. We're going to see all of these things occur. And during this time, we're going to have truth spoken. We're told that the truth is going to be spoken. It's going to be out there. But the world isn't going to love the truth. Now, because of the time that we live in, we have a greater understanding of what this means. What it means that the whole world is going to be able to see what's going on. We have technology now that has given us the ability that we can say something here and anybody around the world can see what happens. And one of the big things that's going to occur, we have two groups. We have two pairs that are going to be working simultaneously. There's going to be one pair that claims to be divine. And when we have another pair, the two witnesses, that claim to be divine. And there's going to be confusion. There's going to be people who don't love the truth. They don't have an understanding of what's going to go on. But one of those pair, it's a world religious leader who promotes a world government leader and views him as a deity. As a God. They do miracles. They do signs. They do wonders. They have some sort of power. A power of Satan. Not of God, but of Satan. Then we have the two witnesses. We have these two witnesses. Those are the other two individuals that are working at the same time frame, trying to give everybody the truth. Spreading the truth. This truth that the world hates. The world doesn't love. And they're going to tell the whole world. And that's where we can understand that this is it can actually be in play. Because what happens in Jerusalem happens here, happens in Russia, Greenland, Antarctica, wherever you are in the world. You're going to be able to see what happens. I'm sure every news outlet's going to be covering every aspect of it. We're going to see these things unfold. And the two witnesses are going to tell the truth. They're going to tell about God's word. The problem is, nobody listens. Most of humanity doesn't listen. They don't want it. They don't respect the two witnesses, the true godly men. They hate the truth. One of the things that tells us that everybody's going to be watching is that when these two witnesses are killed, says the whole world rejoices. The whole world rejoices that these two godly men are finally stopped. There's a component there that should tell us what humanity is. Why we don't get involved with the rest of the world and what they do. What they're doing now. So what we find is we have two men on one side working and two men on the other side working. Performing miracles. Looks like some of the things they do is the same, but they have a very different message. They have a very different understanding of God's words. So some may think that this might be difficult to discern who's actually for God and who's against God. But it's really not. When we really think about the details and what's actually happening here, we can really understand that it's pretty simple. It's a pretty simple thing because the two witnesses, they have zero political power. They have zero influence when it comes to the world. They don't sit in the temple. They don't really seem to have any resources. They don't seem like they have the support of the world. And the other two are. The other two are going to be very different. The only thing the two witnesses can really do is they can send out fire from their mouth and consume their enemies. Now, I've always found that funny, because when it talks about the two witnesses, it makes it seem like it's coming from them. It doesn't come down from heaven or from God, but it comes out of their mouth. And I wonder if God specifically did that to try to make this point, so that those who understand what these two groups are. So we have the two witnesses. They're just doing their job. They're doing the job that God gave them. So what all can we put together from this? After we look at Antiochus Epiphanes, the Roman Empire in 70 AD, we start looking at 2 Thessalonians and seeing what's going to happen in the future. What all can we piece together? What are the things that we're watching for when Jesus Christ actually returns, when He comes? We don't have all the details. I can't give you all the details. But it's important for us to understand this so that we have a definition of the abomination and desolation, so that we know what we're looking for. That's why it's important to know prophecy. It's to know what we're looking for when it happens. Not so that we can predict the future. Not so we can watch things unfolding and say, oh, this has to be it. It's so that we know when it happens what it is. That's why we need these definitions and understanding what it is that we're looking at. These are the things that we look for. We're waiting on this. We're watching for this. And God doesn't give it to us for fear. Some of this stuff is scary. When we look at what has happened to Jerusalem in the past, it's not a fun thing. It wasn't pleasant. Anybody living there, they saw the destruction. Many of them lost their lives. It's not a good thing. But He doesn't give us this stuff to fill us with fear, to make us anxious about what we're living in. This is to help us. It's not to terrify us, but it's to give us things to watch for. It's to give us enough information that we know 100% when it happens that this is God's plan. That this is what God told us was going to happen. This is what He was doing. We know that by these first two fulfillments, that we have these examples of sacrifices being stopped in the temple. It was in the temple that it happened, setting up abominations in the temple. These false things. All of these things happen so we know that they're going to happen again. With 70 AD, we see this fleeing of a group. We didn't see that with Antiochus Epiphanes, but we saw it the second time. So we start being able to get bits and pieces, and then through prophecy, through Scripture, we know those things are still lining up. They're still being coordinated. But in every single one of the cases, there was a temple. And in that temple, those sacrifices were stopped. There was a man who hated everything about God, God's way, God's people, the way they worshiped God, and they stopped it, they changed it, they overtook it, and they set up the false things. They were surrounded by armies. Jerusalem was surrounded by armies. That's what we get to. That's what all of this information that we went through with Matthew 24 and 2 Thessalonians leads us to. As we're going to see these occurrences again. We've been given this information so we know that this is what it comes to. This is what we should be watching for. Because it will happen again. There will be a place in Jerusalem where they do daily sacrifices. Where they establish that this is the altar, this is the temple. Because there has to be an abomination and a desolation that sits in that temple as God at Jesus Christ's return. Who is destroyed by Jesus Christ at His return. We have the model. We've been given two models as examples of what to look for. Little fragments of what's going to be greater in the future. Some people try to make allegories out of this, out of these prophecies. And we don't have to. There's no need for us to make an allegory out of this. We're some pretty imaginative people at times. We make really cool stories and try to figure out what some of this would mean and make up this story, the scenario, but we don't have to. We don't have to do that. We just have to take historical information. We just have to stick to the truth of what God actually has given us. What has happened previously? And use the prophecies of what it says will happen in the future. And we can align all of that together. So that's how we know what's coming again. That's how we know. We know that there's a man of lawlessness who claims to be God. who sits in that temple. He does miracles and wonderful works. He's going to be there. Because we saw that from Antiochus Epiphanes. We saw him invade the temple. This powerful political figure who viewed himself as divine. If we look at most of the rulers throughout history, they viewed themselves as divine. The Roman emperors all thought they were deities. We look at any of the other nationalities, most of them, the empire, the Chinese dynasties, they viewed themselves as deities. Persians, they were gods. The rulers viewed themselves as gods. So we can look through history and see that even these Roman emperors thought they were divine. So it's not going to be really anything new when we see this again. Humanity's just reverting back. We haven't seen it for quite some time. I think there's still some nationalities out there who still believe in divine figures that are leading their countries. But we don't see it like it was in these time frames. But we are going to see it again in the future. We're going to see it again in the future. We're going to see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. And they're not going to be able to take it totally this time. They don't get full control of the when they surround and fight Jerusalem. Because something stops it. And how do we know that? Because if we went over to Zechariah 14, we would see all this. We see that when Christ returns, they're fighting for Jerusalem. We see this battle ensuing. Most of the city's taken, but it's not fully taken over. There's a small group of Jews who are still hanging on fighting. Fighting for what they think is right. And that's when Jesus Christ returns. That's when Jesus Christ comes back. He stops it before Jerusalem's completely destroyed. All of these other things will have been set in place, set in motion. We see all of these things leading up to that. That's why it's important for us to have this definition of the abomination of desolation, understanding exactly what it is, not only historically, but for the future as well, because it will take place again. If you've noticed, most of these things haven't happened. Most of these things haven't taken place. I talked about the Temple Institute and how prepared they are. They're ready for these things to take place. They're going to move as fast as they can if they ever get control of the temple area. If they have their say so, they would be doing it immediately. I have no doubt about that. But we know this is going to be set up again. This is going to be established. That's the whole focal point of Daniel chapter 12. Is that all of this is coming again. And with that, a much greater ending than what they experienced in 164 BC and AD 70. Because Jesus Christ finally actually returns. They aren't precursors. They aren't partial fulfillments. But this takes place just before Jesus Christ returned. Right as he's coming back. And he's going to save his saints. We're going to see the resurrections. All of this has to take place after the abomination of desolation is set up. After it's established. So hopefully this helps you to have a better understanding of what we're looking for in the future. What this prophecy is actually about. What the abomination of desolation means. Because we've seen it twice. We've seen it twice. We've seen it unfold two different times before. We know what to watch for. I've said it. I can't give you dates. I can't give you times, years. I can't give you people, organizations. I don't have those details. Nobody has those details but God. When we start grabbing and trying to fit pieces in, we get lost. We lose track of what God has actually given to us. God has given us the framework and the timeline of what to look for. Some significant pieces of what has to happen in the future before Jesus Christ returns. And that's what we have to latch on to. That has to be the focus. But more importantly, one of the things we need to remember is that God gives us prophecy to increase our faith. To increase our faith. To remind us that we have to be living now. We have to be living a godly life now that exemplifies Him. That is putting us on a different path from the rest of the world. We have to remember what our focus is. More importantly, we have to prepare for the future return of Jesus Christ.